Sending flowers has always been the best way to show someone you care, but it isn't always easy or satisfying. Thankfully, Books.com is a better way to buy flowers with fully transparent pricing and an easy shopping experience and an incredible selection starting at $40. Plus, they take customer service very seriously, so if they make a mistake, they will make it right. Show every mom in your life you care with flowers from the Books Company. Just visit BOUQS.com and enter promo code WATCH for 20% off your Mother's Day purchase. Flowers will sell out, so don't wait.
Hey guys, following its tour de force off-Broadway show, Chris Gethard, Career Suicide, it's coming to HBO. After his public response to an anonymous fan letter about depression went viral, comedian Chris was encouraged to tell stories about the darker moments in his life, merging blunt, unapologetic honesty with his signature brand of comedy. By opening up about his own mental health struggles in this raw, provocative one-man show, Chris's hope is to destigmatize issues like depression and suicide while still being incredibly funny. See how Chris's comedy and extensive stand-up experience cut through this dark subject matter in Chris Gethard, Career Suicide. It's premiering Saturday, May 6th at 10 p.m. on HBO. Chris is a funny and a good guy. I highly recommend it.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am the editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me in the studio, the man from the land down under. Good day.
Wow.
It's Andy Greenwald.
Wow. Look, you just pulled that. Where'd you pull that from?
Well, I didn't pull it from my complete knowledge of Australian accent work.
No.
So, Andy, today's a special episode. We are going to talk about The Leftovers.
Yes.
But we're going to talk about it with a special guest.
Today's guest is Tim Simons, who you may know as Congressman Jonah Ryan from Veep.
I'm going to have a hard time not making a joke about his testicles.
Yes, I understand. I appreciate that. I like that we're pretending we haven't already recorded our conversation.
Yes, this
with
is we're stapling this on.
Very little ball talk, speaking of stapling it on.
Golf ball talk, though.
That's true. It was a great talk. Tim is a really good guy, and it was very fun hearing about how Veep gets made,
yeah.
Who breaks the most when they make jokes on that show, but also how they reacted to certain news events.
Yeah, how the real world affects their world.
And then he joined us for a talk about The Leftovers. Quick little bit of house cleaning. I talked to you, Chris, and
yes,
Tim,
me,
about Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, suggesting that we would be talking about it on Thursday's show. Turns out not the case.
No.
We are going to hit it next Monday, which is fine. Give people more chance to catch up to where we are. I strongly recommend it, despite my misgivings and terror of the dystopic subject matter. Thursday's show is going to be a special show where we talk to one of our musical heroes.
Yeah.
Should we say who it is?
Greg Dooley from the Afghan Whigs will be joining us for the entire episode on Thursday. We've already recorded that. It was a dope conversation.
And can I say, since that happened, Chris and I went to a Phillies-Dodgers game, and Greg Dooley has season tickets, and the Phillies looked like they were going to win. They were defeated in humiliating fashion in front of us, and Greg Dooley, soundtrack maker of my youth and young adulthood, one of our musical gods and heroes, trolled me really hard and texted me a photo of Vin Scully making an LA gesture with his hand. So really just all in all, bang up.
Never
Saturday
meet
night.
Your heroes because they will troll you.
Never meet your heroes.
Okay, we're going to talk to Tim Simons. We're talking to Greg Dooley Thursday, next Monday, Handmaid's, Leftovers, bunch of other stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Let's get into it.
Okay. Why don't we just roll in?
All right.
We're recording right now. Chris, that's because no one likes to hear my voice first. But I'll tell you a voice they do want to hear. Our guest, Tim Simons, is here.
Hey, guys.
Co-star of Veep. You may know him as, well, he has hair now.
Mm-hmm.
But currently on Veep, he doesn't because he's Congressman Jonah
Ryan. Did you
Ryan.
Method that? That wasn't not a cap, right?
No, I methoded.
That's great.
I methoded it. I methoded it. I fully shaved my head. And then I didn't shave my eyebrows. And this is 100% true. I didn't want to shave them because in the fourth grade, a kid named Lenny told me that if you shave them, they don't grow back.
Calling him out.
So, yeah I'm calling out Lenny Ray. And I believe that. I don't know if that's true or not. It's probably not.
But it might be.
It might be.
And look, this is the face area. That is your,
that's your money maker.
That's the money
bread and butter. Yeah.
You can't.
And people, that's what people say. Like when they say like, oh, we want Tim Simons. We want that. We want that face.
Yeah.
That like, oh, it's a bird of prey that fucked a muskrat. Like we want that. Get us that face. That's the one we need. But I did. And then in the first, like they did cover my eyebrows.
Okay.
With some prosthetic and then painted over.
What was the magic of Hollywood?
Magic of Hollywood. But in the first episode, everybody's like, "Wow, that ball cap looks great." And I'm like, "God damn it! I shaved my head, and I'm not even getting credit for it."
Was that the first time you shaved your head?
I had my dad like did like the my dad was mid my dad was grew up in Michigan. He's from the Midwest. So yeah. Like when I was 13, one time he was just like, "Man, you're getting a buzz cut this summer." Like that's the only other time. So I have like a, it was a very awkward period.
I guess we should move on from the hair.
No, that's all right.
This is so far we're 3 episodes into this season 6, which is crazy to believe.
It really is, yeah.
And I know this is well covered territory, but I still am fascinated on your perspective of it. Veep had a reputation, I mean, obviously as one of, if not the funniest shows on TV, but there was an argument that we've made on the show a lot over the years. We talked to Dan Pfeiffer and Jon Favreau about this, that House of Cards is the show that Washington wishes it was, mm-hmm. but Veep is the show it really is.
Yeah.
And then, as you're very familiar, history went psychotic last year, and suddenly these lines diverge, and Veep... You know, everyone thought of themselves first and the mushroom cloud in our potentially in our future. But then a lot of people did turn to Veep and like, well, what's this show going to do now? You were already in pre-production, I believe.
We had shot 3 episodes. The episode that you saw last night.
Okay.
The opening scene where they are watching people vote. That was the scene that they were filming when all the returns were coming in.
What happened? Not in the country, because we still don't know that.
Yeah.
You can answer what happened on the set of Veep, which you film out here now, right?
We film in LA, and I'll take you through some of the things. Like, I wasn't working that night. So what happened to me was I ordered wine and cigarettes from the internet and got really drunk and angry on Twitter, mm-hmm. and then took a really long walk at like 2 a.m. mm-hmm. thinking to myself, how am I going to raise small children, one of which is a girl, in this new horrible America.
I can't believe I didn't see you out there on the streets at that hour.
You remember the next morning when you would just drive
around?
You
were delivering the wine and cigarettes.
I don't know if I've talked about this in the podcast, but the next morning, I drove my daughter to school. Mm-hmm. And as we pulled up at her school, my nose erupted in a geyser of blood because I had a stress nosebleed.
Oh, my God.
And,
well, yeah, of course you did. Of course you did.
And we walked into school and everyone in our little... liberal bubble on the east side of Los Angeles. All the teachers, everyone had like red rimmed eyes. They mm-hmm. all smelled like the cigarettes you'd probably been smoking. And I had to one up them. And I walked in looking like I just got in a bar fight. It was a memorable morning.
Yeah. It was like that thing. You remember in the movie Blade, where at one point, like they show Blade's car, like driving down the street. And then you see a vampire feeding on someone. It was just to show you like there was like a lot of world building in that. The world building of Los Angeles on that morning was mm-hmm. you just drove by people and you would just see people crying in the street mm-hmm. On the corner. You would just see people crying. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Except at John Voight's house. Like we should say, Los Angeles is a large and varied metroplex.
Just throwing scarves everywhere up in the air in celebration.
Buying his own cigarettes in person.
Actually, the guy that dropped them off from, I ordered them from yummy.com, which is the dumbest store name that's ever existed, but a fine service.
It's actually pretty convenient, though,
it's
when you think about it,
because
like, there
service.
Is a cutoff in LA where you had like the 2 beers at home, and you're like, mm-hmm. I'd love like a third or a fourth.
Yeah.
But... And then you're saying yummy.com will be here in
you
half
know about
an hour.
Yummy.com?
I'm new here. Yeah. I don't know about that.
It's kind of weird because it's like, remember Cosmo?
Yeah, that was...
It almost feels like the web interface feels like that, where it was like just like early version of like, I'd like a VHS of The Matrix and a pint of Ben & Jerry's. You know,
it
like,
is exactly
first of all,
that, yeah.
All Cosmo.com orders during the 6 months of its existence contained a Ben & Jerry's pint.
Yeah.
I also ordered the Macy Gray album and Ghostface Killah Supreme
just
Clientele.
To see if you could
do the opposite
it.
Spin from Cosmo. And it cost like a $2 delivery fee. So
that was
why
it
didn't work. Well, I had to pay for what I bought.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But
there are times, if you just need a Ghostface Killah CD and you're drunk, like I'd gladly pay more than $2 for that.
Yeah.
The guy who dropped it off did say that like, all my deliveries have been wine and cigarettes, man. You're not special. And but it's so
was that how he like greeted you at the door?
Honestly, I got the sense that he was like super happy about.
Oh yeah.
Like I got the sense that these were being dropped off by somebody who was happy to see my
Hollywood libtards.
Hollywood libtards.
Why
do I have to get out of? Why
do
I don't know if you guys want to make this political? Why do I have to get out of my fucking bubble?
Yeah.
Why I grew up in a fucking town of 2,000 people. I grew up in the fucking woods.
Yeah.
and everybody had a fucking pickup truck, and we had a snowmobile fucking parking lot. And I don't get why the fuck I have to get out of my goddamn bubble. I moved here so that I could get a varied point of view.
You lived in a place where people told you lies about your facial hair and its odds of growing back.
Yeah.
Yes.
You have earned this.
I have earned this.
You've earned this life in a place of
with
freedom,
blood
truth,
and eyebrows. Yeah.
God. Okay. So we all had rough nights.
And then, so I think what ended up happening
was do you have like a Slack channel for the people who work at Veep where you're just all like trading messages?
Yeah. Do you guys have like a group text where you're like, holy shit?
There is definitely like a writer's group text, which I think that they all, of course, it's just like, again, untold amount of bits. I'm not on that one. I ended up having to go do, like I had to sit in on an audition to read against some people 2 days later. And I have like, I've said this before, but that like the timing worked out that like we were going to be able to film like 3 days of, we were set to schedule like, or we were scheduled to shoot maybe 3 days of the following week. And then something was, and then we were going to have a hiatus that included Thanksgiving. And so I think what ultimately happened, if I'm remembering this correctly, is we just didn't shoot those 3 days. They really were like, we're kind of on a longer, like a 2 week hiatus anyway. Let's take some time and have some philosophical conversations about what this means. Because of course, everybody was ignoring it because it was a joke and continues to still be a joke, only a much more serious one. Yeah. So people with much higher pay grades than mine, that being Julia and Dave and, you know, Lou Morton, I think they had like that philosophical conversation. But when I was in there in the writer's room a couple of days later, the only thing that I can relate it to was a funeral, in that like it was very quiet. There was a lot of hugging. There would be a joke and then like a burst of cleansing laughter that would fall into a reflective silence. Nobody, I mean, like everybody was still sort of reeling from it. And so it's hard to then switch your brain into like, well, how can we make this funny? I think what they ultimately settled on was that we were in a good position to deal with it.
You guys already had the Georgia plot line then, if you shot the first three.
That's and that so was wild. The weird thing. Like, so as those returns were coming in during that scene, like there were like 100 extras in that, and there was a full video village. And they just said that in between takes, it was dead silent. So it was very eerie that they're watching this thing about an election. But I think ultimately they just kind of came up with this idea that we were, story-wise, we were lucky that we weren't dealing with an election season, because honestly, who would want to watch that?
Yeah.
And that also we were far enough away in these sort of alternate timelines that we were lucky that we don't have to deal with it directly. Mm-hmm. Because like, I mean, like, you know, like any Trump joke, any dumb thing that he does, that joke is played out by noon that day. So like a parody of that is not going to happen from us.
Also, the thing that makes Veep so remarkable is it's not that the government is rendered as incompetent. It's people are savage and genius and brilliant and clever, but for all the wrong things.
Yes.
And it's political savagery and it's blood sport, basically, or verbal blood sport anyway. It's not about just rank incompetence, which is what we see now. And it's a different kind of humor.
Yeah. It's also the thing where it's like to me, my favorite kind of satire is when the characters don't know it's a satire.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, cause you can have like that Daffy kind of lampooning, like, you know, especially if you do like parodies of movies or something like that. And you'll see people and they're like, we got to hit all the beats that you're expecting that you would get from a normal movie like this or a normal show. But the thing about watching, even in like the slight turn some of the characters on Veep are making, because we were just talking before we got in here about how they've kind of, in the first few episodes, like Julia's character is like almost a villain now. You know what I mean? In a weird way. And it's like, and maybe it's more in this time you look at somebody who is kind of just like, what can I do to like enrich myself through like my past accomplishments here? But that's become such like a huge issue now that it changes the way you view it. But yeah, I think that the fact that you guys are, that have always just sort of been in your own universe that's like walled off from the real world and then thus reflects it is why it's always been so successful.
And I do think that like as it goes forward, I don't think that they necessarily, and Dave has brought this up, that Selena herself, like to your point, has some Trump qualities in that, like, that have always been there. This idea that like she considers herself like a champion of the working person, but would, it, like, if she touched a working person, would ask Gary for hand sanitizer immediately. I think as the season goes forward, you might see some things that might remind you mm-hmm. of the world, but only in this way that it's like examining like thought process or root cause behind something that might cause somebody like him. Does that, if that makes
yes.
sense?
Yes. Well, I yeah. also think it was an advantage that one of the developments of the show, and I think it was a successful one, both creatively, but also in terms of the longevity of the show, is that what began potentially as a satire of institutions has become a comedy about characters.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, and certainly I think, and we're actually going to have Dave on the show at some point soon too.
Oh, nice.
We can talk to him about this, but the change last year.
He'll
which
give
was,
you all sorts of smart answers that I won't be
no,
able to give you.
No, you're killing it so far. We're mostly going to ask him about your hair.
Okay.
But the change that he put in last year that was subtle and actually just remarkable when you look it back at it was that he nudged it towards this more serialized ensemble piece that allows it to have this season where the characters are in the wilderness and it's still the show that we like. It's still the people that we like. The only thing that I noted from these first two or three episodes is that some of the foundation and library stuff seemed Clintonian in a way, you know, because that was in the news and we were thinking about that.
Yeah.
And not to say that there weren't, not to say that the show was picking on Clinton. It's just that those were known knowns, you know.
Yeah.
Like those were ripe targets for satire. And then everything got topsy turvy.
And it's a strange thing, like all of this stuff that she's doing with her post-presidency, like we're seeing. With like this sort of like reemergence of Barack Obama coming out of that really long vacation that he had, like we're now starting to see him and we're starting to see those conversations around, like I don't necessarily agree, but like you see like that criticism of him taking a paid speaking gig or whatever, like that, like I feel like if Trump wasn't in office, we'd be seeing a lot more of that, but it's kind of getting, that's the kind of thing that he wanted to. That I think Dave really wanted to look at is that post-presidency life. And it's kind of getting buried under just like this avalanche of bad news. But I do like that there is this sort of weird parallel between Selena's post-presidency life and what is going on with Barack Obama at this very moment.
What is it like this many years into the show to be a part of this truly exceptional ensemble? Because, you know, the best comedies, especially the best ensemble comedies, become like these symphonies where everyone plays their instrument and they're the greatest player of that instrument and they all know how to play together. You know, the expert showrunners juggle the pieces and juggle the instrumentation, to continue the probably bad metaphor. But when you go off on hiatus and you do other projects, then you come back together and you start to look at the pages and the jokes and the opportunities you're going to have to play with other people. What is the camaraderie like? What is the excitement level like to have these jokes and to play these scenes with?
I think one thing, as I was talking to somebody about this the other day, that like when people ask me about it, I sort of reflexively smile. And I do that because even 6 years in, the process of making this show and the experience of mm-hmm. making it is still a very happy one for me. Like the end product matches my experience in making it. And so, so I find myself like, I love getting back into it. And this far on, like we still work together as well as an ensemble. And I do miss, like we moved from Baltimore to Los mm-hmm. Angeles last year. And there were some growing pains in that. Like I had never had to balance work and family before. Mm-hmm. And so that was a challenging thing. I had only ever gone to Baltimore and only thought about work mm-hmm. 24 hours a day. And once we were done shooting, we would all go to a bar and have a glass of wine and talk about scenes for the next day and pitch jokes. And we would see the writers like frantically working on something mm-hmm. Over a beer at like midnight.
Yeah.
And you would talk to them for a half an hour. And I missed that. But all of like the base that we got as an ensemble from 4 years of doing that is still there, even though I don't mm-hmm. get to see everybody socially as much because we all have families, we all have kids. But one of the things I do like that Dave has done is he really likes mixing up mm-hmm. groups. And you've seen that last year and you're now seeing that again this year, where as much as I miss playing scenes with Sam Richardson, who is unbelievably funny, I didn't see Kent or Ben. I didn't see Gary or Kevin Dunn. I saw them at table reads last mm-hmm. year. I don't think I had a single scene with those guys. And now I got to spend this entire year doing scenes just with them. And I love the fact that Sam gets to do a lot of work with Julia. Like mm-hmm. you get to see these different mixes, which in a way keeps it fresh. Like I love going back to the two-man rivalry of Dan and Jonah. Mm-hmm. Like I always love
Danny
going
now.
Back to
it's Danny.
Yeah, Danny. I love I'm Dan Egan. I love going back to that, and that we keep hitting that, and that you see Sam and, or that you see Jonah and Richard get back and get back together for a moment in episode three.
And but I think and that go to a Nazi rock club.
We go to a Nazi rock club. And Sam and I were both like looking around that day, being like, is there anybody enjoying this too much?
Is anybody like, who's just like, actually, it wouldn't be like this. It would be standing like a little bit like more in unison. Yeah.
Guys, it's not like this at all. When I still get excited. I still get excited to go back to it. There are jokes. I mean, every single table read, there is just like, there is just sometimes like a brutal joke that like even 6 years in, the amount of brutality that this show has thrown out, there's still one that like really just hurts your heart. I really do still look forward to it. Yeah.
When did you guys stop shooting this season? When did you guys wrap?
We wrapped right at the beginning of March.
Okay. So yeah. I was curious with that. So you've been with this group of people for such a long time, and we were talking about how it was to shoot and then take a break after the election. But one of the things that's been interesting working in an office in that time period, you know, is noting how different people have coped in different ways or you know, decided like, I'm just not going to look at Politico for about 2 weeks now, or I'm not going to look at talking like Twitter for a little while, or have become even more, you know, politicized and been like, I'm worried about getting this person in suburban Georgia, like elected or whatever. Was it like that on the set? Did you see people like kind of coping in different ways? And, or was it more like, because of the nature of what you guys are working on, you guys are all talking about it all the time?
We were kind of all talking about it. We kind of always do talk about it all the time, I think, because like Frank Rich is one of our executive producers. And I think, I mean, I was interested in politics, and I sort of nominally knew a little bit about it. I tried to keep up, but I didn't really know much. But since working on this show, like day to day, I kind of do keep up a little bit more, especially like when you have an asset or like in somebody like Frank Rich, who you can talk to about day to day political stuff, and he can put those things in a historical context. Like there, I can't tell you how many times I've gone up to him, just been like, Frank, what does this mean? Like this very small thing that seems to be making a big wave. Like, why is that happening? Mm-hmm. And he will walk you through sort of years of history, what that means. So we always did talk about it. Matt Walsh he and I talk about it a lot. He, I think, is fascinated. He has issues and things that he is very, that he's involved in, but I think also just enjoys politics. And so he and I would talk about it a lot. I don't know. It almost seemed like everybody kind of stayed in their lane, and their lane was heightened a little bit.
Yeah, right.
Like if you were political, you got a little bit more political. If you were somebody that was like, I'm going to jump in and out of this, you jumped in and out of it. Like with a little bit more, you jumped out of it a little bit further,
yeah, right,
you jumped into it a little bit further. If you were somebody that just kind of put on blinders a little bit more. And I think that this was so terrible. Like I can't begrudge anybody if they were like, I really needed to like not think about this.
Yeah, just like watch March Madness and not talk
about
like this.
I do support it. I do support it as long as it isn't escapism forever. Like escape for a little bit, fine, but then like get back in it because this is pretty terrible out here.
I just waited for the nosebleeds to stop. I had to quit Twitter for 3 months, and that was very cleansing.
I get it.
That was helpful.
Yeah.
I sent him the best tweets though, so.
Actually, it was kind of enjoyable to have someone, he's like, here's the meme you missed. And he's like, there's a guy pointing to his head, and that means I'm fine with this. I've made the right choices.
I will say that like an extended Twitter is trash and it's garbage.
Yep.
And I feel like extended breaks from that are good. I think I'm going to start doing like I tried last summer and to reasonable success. Basically, I'll stick around until the end of the run of the show.
Sure.
I'll do all that. And then I'm going to take.
It's a professional obligation.
Yeah.
A professional obligation. Yeah. And also screaming.
Yeah.
And then.
That's really what it is.
It's really.
You should use that in there.
Screaming into a void. And then I think I'll take like the summer and fall off, and I'll take a step away. And I'll give you my phone number, and you can just text me.
I'll just hit you up with the best memes. Yeah.
The best. Oh, solid.
You got to hear about this music festival, man. Ja Rule.
You'll never believe it. We could go down the list, obviously, and talk about many of your castmates, but I specifically want to ask you about Kevin Dunn because I think that low key, he may be the greatest performer on television.
He's like the Paul Pierce of television.
Yes.
He's like always there, always winning rings.
And always and great in drama, too. But in this role, what he does, I just think week in and week out, is astonishing.
Yeah.
Everything he does physically, intonation, everything is brilliant.
You're not wrong. I think, like, it's funny. I think of Kevin Dunn and Gary Cole sort of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
In that, like, Kevin Dunn is he's like bluster and fire and anger
and bile. Yeah.
And Gary Cole is like very studied and very even, but they both have done everything and they've both worked with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what, like, their reads on comedy and their reads on drama are exactly the same.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do, but I do think you're right. Like, when you watch Kevin do this, I don't know how he does it, but everything is so effortless, but so full and rich of hate or anger or whatever it is that's going on in that moment, that like when he tells Selena in that first episode, like, ma'am, you can't do it.
Yeah.
It has, I was watching that scene. I was just like, God damn. Like, he's
it's
just
like David Milch, like, wrote it or something. Like,
yeah,
the way, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It had like this thing. Like, I just truly believed that he was a political animal, yeah, telling somebody they couldn't do that.
It also felt like the lighting changed, like as if something had been done with production, because everything got heavy for a second.
Yes.
And it was still the same performance.
But it was still the same performance.
Also, like, that show moves. It's like always about to burst into another room. And that was like a very still scene, like, where, yeah, it was like very like, it's just these two people on a table and they're like, nobody's bursting in. Nobody's like handing her a phone or, mm-hmm, like, you know, there's no like pratfall like, mm-hmm, next. It was like a very, like, so much like pathos in that moment.
And he has this ability. One of the things I always love about Ben is that you always feel like he's on the precipice of suicide, but there's something that's happening. Like, he gives himself, it's like this, like a ferocious resolve. He's like ferociously resigned, mm-hmm, into like everything is awful, but you just got to keep going and the sweet relief of death will one day come.
That's actually a good design for life now, I think, in Trump's America.
Kind of
that's
is.
Sort of how I feel.
The crazy
day.
Thing about Gary Cole is that, like, you look at him and you're like, oh yeah, like Gary Cole, like
Midnight
he's
Caller.
Like, yeah, or it's just like you think of him and you think of like the way, like, you know, like Sam Elliott's been like Sam Elliott for like, mm-hmm, 150 years. Like, you just think he, yeah, was born with a white mustache. But Gary Cole actually is like, plays like a wide variety of roles. Like, it was funny watching like the end of The Good Fight while Veep was starting, and then also just thinking about like anything from like Dodgeball and Office Space, but then also all the drama stuff that he's done.
And the Brady, yeah, Bunch movies.
Yeah, and the Brady Bunch movies and
The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. Fuck,
yeah.
Why can't I remember
Talladega
the main?
Nights. Oh, yeah.
Talladega Nights. Yeah. Like, that's so different. Pineapple Express.
Yeah.
Is he a funny guy, yeah, in real life, or is he a quiet, like, is he just a measured guy that can turn it on?
He's measured, but he will joke around. That's one of the things I love about Gary, is that he is absolutely unflappable.
Yeah.
No matter what happens, we could be on an 18-hour day, or you could be in and out, and you'd be like, how you doing, Gary? He's like, I'm good. You know, like, he is just so, but like, he'll get into it. I saw him get fired up once about, yeah, the interview getting pulled out of theaters. I've never seen him that fired up.
The film, the Seth Rogen film, the interview.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, he
doesn't want North Korea to win.
No. I was like, he very rarely gets fired up like that, but he really got into that.
He's just like, what's up, man? You okay? Like,
yeah. Like, yeah. I absolutely agree that Kevin Dunn is just, he's stunningly good on that show.
I don't ask this to shine a negative light on anyone, but I'm curious, who is most likely to break in a scene? Because I'm sure on this show,
oh yeah,
people
who's
break.
Jimmy Fallon?
Oh, it's Gary, it's Tony Hale.
Really?
Oh, it's absolutely Tony Hale.
Oh, really?
100% across the board. I
didn't see that coming.
I will do it sometimes, and when it happens, it's hard for me to get out.
Yeah.
There was one in an episode a couple weeks ago when Bacadol says something like, I was watching you squeeze that that log out of your face anus, but he kept accidentally adding peanut to log, and I was just sitting there like, come on, man. I couldn't fucking keep it together. It's like every once in a while, like something, or like I remember from season two when I had to deliver the news of like the very somber news that like one of the people on like a raid, like a military raid, had lost their leg, and mm-hmm, it became like a thing with Selena. I had to deliver that news. Like, it was so somber and so quiet, I couldn't fucking keep it together. So when I go hard, but Tony is just across the board, almost incapable of keeping it together.
And we want to get your thoughts on other shows, but just finally on Veep, Jonah's had quite a ride. Although when you watch the show, and I went back a little bit just to see, I was curious if the show would strike me differently now that I've been watching Dave's version of the show for a few years.
Yeah.
And your performance is remarkably consistent. This guy, you are committed to this guy through whatever permutation life or the writers throw at him, which I think, I mean, that truly is a compliment to the performance. But it suggests to me that you are able to just sort of echolocate the humanity, whatever is left of it, and hold cling to it, right? I mean, you must. How do you hold on? Let me rephrase that. What do you hold on to as he goes from internet journalism to
speed
the halls
dating.
Of Congress and speed dating, all the things?
I think the thing that I hold on to is that no matter what is happening and no matter what obstacle gets in his way, no matter what tragedy befalls him, he has confidence that it's all moving in the right direction and that he will ultimately be successful and powerful. Like, no matter what, I do think that he has a bottomless well of self-confidence. Despite all evidence to the contrary, he would never allow himself to think like it's all over, I'm going to fail. And I think that's the thing that I grab onto as far as like how he keeps going through this. And then the other thing, as far as like the grasping for the humanity, I do like that he has moments where, and you like that he has moments where things affect him. I think I just have to do like a funhouse mirror of like, how would this affect a human and how would a human react to it? And then do the funhouse mirror version of that, where it's just like when it came to like his molestation, I remember like talking to Armando and Simon, and as that was being built, like there were things that, and they were on board from this right from the beginning. But like when they started telling me about it, I really wanted it to never become like a gay scare, which is of course like a thing that happens all the time, or it's like historically been like sort of like we've done enough gay scares, and also that it really weighed on him, that it was like that it was making him question like, well, this is all I've ever wanted to do, and is this something that I should put up with in order to keep working at this job, like I am now, or is this just how it's going to be now? And this is not the way that I wanted it, but I never wanted him to see the one-to-one of his own behavior toward women in his workplace.
Right.
Like he would be like, I'm getting sexually harassed over here and that is terrible. And he'd be like, hey, Linda, you look great. You know, like he never, so like that's sort of the thing. Like he has a humanity, but it is a funhouse mirror version of humanity.
Guys, we're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Tim to hear a word from our sponsors. What's that sound? Amazon's acclaimed crime series, Bosch, is back for a third season. Titus Welliver stars as Detective Harry Bosch, an honest cop driven by a dark past who is obsessed with punishing criminals, no matter what the cost. Haunted by the discovery that his mother's murder was covered up by the police, Bosch also finds himself implicated in the death of a serial killer he's investigating. It's a tough Tuesday at the office. Now Bosch must navigate the dangerous waters of a police department that believes he's guilty, while working with a partner who is no longer sure he can trust him. Bosch will fight to prove his innocence. That's the Bosch way, even as he pursues a dangerous group of ex-Special Forces assassins willing to kill anyone who gets in their way. Against the glamour and seediness of Los Angeles, Bosch will risk everything to clear his name while bringing down the murderous crime ring, no matter how many rules he has to break to do it. This series is based on the best-selling series of novels by Michael Connelly. I highly recommend the series, books and TV. Stream season 3 of Bosch now on Amazon Prime. Buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated and confusing. I should know. I'm often confused by complicated things. But there is a better, simpler way to buy. It's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just 2 taps. Not 3, 2. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I found to shop for tickets or to share tickets. Because, guys, I use SeatGeek this weekend. Chris Ryan, bought me a ticket to see my favorite team, the Phillies, play the Dodgers in beautiful Dodger Stadium. And then he shared the ticket with me just over the app. It was incredibly seamless. It was incredibly easy. And I still enjoyed the night, even though my team was savagely defeated in the ninth inning by back-to-back-to-back home runs. You'll be hearing a lot more about that. Anyway, with the SeatGeek app, I can be anywhere, and with just a few of those taps, I can instantly find seats. SeatGeek saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Not confidence your team will win, but confidence you'll have the right tickets. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, listeners of The Watch get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app. Go to the Settings tab and click Add a Promo Code. Enter promo code WATCH. SeatGeek will send you $20, 20 American dollars, after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WATCH today. Okay, business taken care of. Let's get back into our conversation with Veep's Tim Simons. We wanted to talk to you a little bit about The Leftovers, your neighbor on Sunday nights on HBO. We, just by way of background, we are all in on this show. You're, now. We were all in on the season.
Were you ever not all in?
Yes.
Okay.
I was way out.
Last year?
I hated
even?
The first season.
Okay.
And then the second season astounded me and drew me in.
Okay.
And then we had Lindelof come in. We hashed it out. We're all friends now.
Okay.
Even though he still thinks I'm totally wrong about season one. And I insist that I'm still right.
Okay.
And maybe he thinks so too. He just won't admit it.
Okay. I think I might be halfway in between you and he on season one, but we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we can get into it. But so last night was the third episode.
Mm-hmm.
And a tour de force.
A bottle app, kind
for Scott Glenn.
Yeah.
I love the show, and I love this episode. It represents to me what I think is so phenomenal about the show. It went all the way to 11 on an idea that could have just been tossed off as a joke.
Yeah, if that had been an episode of Lost, it would have been a 7-minute subplot of a larger episode.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about that the whole time, where I was like, I think that the one remaining, it's not like a criticism, it's more of an experiential problem with watching The Leftovers, is that there is enough what is going to happen going on that, like, I am anxious no matter what is on. So, like, even if it's like this, like, hey, we're just hanging out, or like there's like this really human moment, or we're learning about a character we haven't learned before, I'm like, what's going to happen? Like, we're obviously walking through the outback. Like, what is the end point here?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a feeling that I don't get watching Billions, watching Veep, watching a bunch of other shows where I'm not like, what is it? Are we going to find out that God does exist or doesn't exist? Or is Kevin Jesus or not? Yeah. And that's like a strange feeling to have when you're watching, especially a 57-minute episode.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not criticism as much as it's like, it is a unique feeling when you're watching television to be like, what the hell?
Do you put it also in that same world of, like, when you say that, I think of watching Game of Thrones, that feeling of like, this could be the thing where just like, you're just watching a scene of two people talking and then somebody's going to get the top of their head cut off and you would have no, it's like, is it that feeling of just like, this could this could all just change so suddenly?
Well, I always think of Game of Thrones is all going in one direction and there is going to be casualties along that way. And I love that feeling of consequences in Game of Thrones. I think it's one of the best parts of the show is that it takes a genre that at least in television and film has often been like, but the hobbits are going to win, so don't worry about it. And it's like, well, no, I mean, actually all the people that should win die.
Yeah.
In The Leftovers, I think it's more that it is grappling with these like cosmic existential questions in this very idiosyncratic way. And so rather than it being a story in the most traditional sense, I've started to like come to terms. And I think this was sort of like the big thing that helped me understand in the second season. And it's why I love the show, is that it's more of like a book of short stories. And the short stories in the end will thematically be about something, but it's not going to be a novel that answers a question at the end.
It's interesting for me to hear your take on watching the show, because, and this might be a symptom of my dislike of the first season, how I've come back to it. I don't want to say, I was going to say I don't care. It's not that I don't care. I never think about where it's going or what it means. or what we're what the reveal is going to be, or why they disappeared, or what it's headed to. And for me, that's given me a real sense of peace because I'm just on this ride. And I feel like that's sort of what Damon wanted to do in general, coming from a show that was all give me the answers, give me the answers. But also, in its own way, a meditation on belief and religion like the show itself is. It's and this was a real theme of this episode as well. It's like she's like Lindsay Duncan's character is like, you think I'm crazy or I'm a monster. And he's like, I don't, because you got to do what you got to do. Right, and yeah, we all have to walk our own road here.
Yeah.
I find that very calming in a way, even as the show goes in all sorts of directions.
I think I'm more in that world of like, as I watch it now. And I think that the thing that I thought about the first season, and I did enjoy the first season, mm-hmm, but I remember toward the end of it, I think it was in the episode where it's Matt, right? The mm-hmm preacher, yeah, brother. And that episode where he goes and he gambles and wins, yes, all that money. There was a moment, I think I like leaned, I talked to my wife and I were watching it together, and I was like, I don't think I can handle just watching him ultimately get beat up and lose this money, which may happen. That's, I think,
exactly,
and maybe
how
it
I felt.
Did.
Right.
But there was a, like, I don't know. There was something about it that it was so heavy all the time that in a way, I thought it was almost unrealistic, because no matter what tragedy hits, mm-hmm, people, there is one person in your world that deals with tragedy by telling jokes, and nobody in that world told, yeah, jokes ever. And that was the one thing that I didn't like about the first season, but it never lost me. I was just like, this is so heavy. I just wish they'd get out of the heaviness a little bit.
I could not agree with you more. That was, yeah, exactly my complaint as well. And it was heartening. And obviously we could see it in the results. But when we had Damon in here the other week, he said that he, due to, you know, unfortunate circumstances in his actual life, he went to some funerals between seasons one and two, yeah, and remembered that what gets us through them is laughter, and that,
yeah,
wakes are as important as funerals, and,
yeah,
and there's light always. Otherwise, why do you do any of it? Well, and that, there was that punishing feeling in the first season, yeah, that I resented.
There was, and as it's gone on, there is something beautiful about, I really love the fact that they basically, like, I haven't talked to anybody at HBO about it, but like, I kind of love that they were like, yeah, the third season is going to be the last one. And it's like, this maybe, like, this was never going to be like a huge commercial hit, but mm-hmm, they were basically like, we have some of the most talented people in the entire fucking universe.
Yeah.
Let's just examine something that doesn't necessarily go anywhere. But I do feel this is very hyperbolic, but there is something about watching that show this season, and definitely through parts of last year as well. Not the episode from last night, but I was thinking about this from the one before, mm-hmm, it. About Carrie Coon when she goes to, yeah, the hotel, and that, just like, it's just in a way sometimes like a blank canvas for you to think about loss, for you to just project your own stuff onto it, to then just have the experience of, it doesn't really matter where it is going. It's just about thinking about those things. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I think that's why I've loved it so much.
And I like the way you're putting it in the frame of HBO bankrolling this and allowing it to happen, because honestly, where we are with TV, like, what else are we doing it for? Like, we don't need Daredevil season 5 or another punch. Like, we can have those things, and that's great. Like, spend money on it. But, like, there has to be some,
yeah,
National Endowment for the Arts, basically. Yeah, sorry, like, to make it political again. I'm not saying this is charity.
This might be HBO just being like, here is a gift for all of you.
But there is profit to be made in everything. But I like it when I see some decisions that at least you could say, without looking at their spreadsheets, there was a little bit more than return on investment, yeah, here.
And I do think, at one point, and this, so I was in a movie with Tracy Letts. Mm-hmm. And so he and I think this was in between.
Is it Gold?
Christine.
Oh, okay.
So.
Tracy Letts, Pulitzer Prize winning playwright.
And
husband of Carrie Coon.
And husband of Carrie Coon from The Leftovers. And so we actually, I think it was like season one had just finished.
Occasional
filming.
CIA director on
Occasional
Homeland.
CIA director
Occasional
on
once
Homeland.
In future.
And maybe a surprise to people that don't know him, massively funny. And we'll sit in with TJ and Dave, is a long running improv show in Chicago that Dave Pasquese, who plays Andrew on Veep, Selena's ex-husband. He is a revered and legendary Chicago improviser, and he does a show called TJ and Dave with a guy named TJ Jagodowski, and Tracy Letts will sit in when one of them can't.
Wow.
So I got to see Dave Pasquese and Tracy do maybe an hour and a half one time, and it was one of the best things I've ever seen. He is a unbelievably funny man in the same way that Kevin Dunn is. Yeah. Like it's the same read. It's the same read, but it's so great. But we were talking about it, about The Leftovers, and we had that conversation about the heaviness and the weight. And one of the and hearing him say this, because I had not looked it up, I had not researched about the book or the short story that it was based on, was in response to 9/11. Mm-hmm. And it's not hearing him say, like, it's not about where it's going, and it's not about figuring out where they go. It's just about how do you deal with people who have just been taken from you with no explanation and no way to get them back, and like what humans might go to try to cope with that. Mm-hmm. I think once just hearing that has colored the rest of my enjoyment of it.
It's interesting how for some reason last night's episode made me think a lot about Lost. I think partially because there was a little bit of like, there's obviously a lot of religious imagery going on, but in Lost, that's a secret world. Like, nobody knows about this island. Nobody knows what happened to these people. It was a blip. It was a flight that disappeared or whatever. And even in these flashbacks, it's just such a normal world. Or rather, it's like, that's the secret. But in this world, in The Leftovers, you'd think that this is the only thing anyone would ever talk about for the rest of their lives. Do you know what I mean? Like, that would just be... If we think Trump is dominating our conversations, like, imagine if I disappeared and you saw it happen and I was just like gone.
You would like, finally, the Andy Greenwald podcast can flourish.
What the Greenwalds? No, it would just be, it's interesting that this is like, it flips that. So there, rather than it being like, well, this is about a world underneath the world, this is about like this parallel thing. This is about, okay, so this happened, because it was interesting that Scott Glenn and Lindsay Duncan find each other like two crazy kids just trying to make something of this world.
Such good actors.
But in Lost, that would almost make more sense because it would be like they were the two people with the truth. Yeah. Whereas like in this, it's wild how like they are even in this crazy world pushed to the far limits of understanding searching.
But I love the humanity of that, because the one thing we've learned, yes, since the election, but in general, is that what humans want more than anything else is survival and also to normalize. You desperately want to get back to a baseline no matter what. And one of the smartest things the show did, Leftovers did, was jump forward 3 more years. Mm-hmm. So now we're 7 years past it. And if anything, people would have clawed their way back to some normalcy, including overreacting to it, which is what that Department of Disappearances is doing, basically trying to tamp down any more strangeness. Yeah. And I love that that tension in the world, because, you know, one of the things, and this was in the first season too, and I give them a lot of credit for this, people do vanish from our lives, and then we have to deal with it. It's not a goodbye, Chris. This is quite a traumatic way to go. Last point on that episode that I want to bring up.
Can I just say one more thing? It remains a breathtaking show.
This is my show now.
But that's actually the beautiful irony of that episode last night was it's Scott Glenn getting a bottle episode while complaining that the story is about his son.
Yeah.
You know, it was like this amazing thing where he's just like, it's my story. Like, why aren't I in this New Testament? And it's like, it's your episode, bro. Do whatever you want.
Paint
it's
your
amazing.
Body and dance,
it was
Scott
such a
Glenn.
Great, it was such a great little, like, almost a weird joke about acting, but also about storytelling, about like when people are the hero and when people are, you know, are you Jesus or are you John the Baptist? You know,
the point I wanted to make was similarly meta, in that just purely as a fan of how television gets made, the reason why I'm just so completely all in on this season is, and maybe this is colored from my experience actually being in writers' rooms now, but like the fun of a writer's room is, well, we know we want X to go to Y, and we need Z to happen. And then you sit in the room and you throw out the ideas how those things are going to happen. And The Leftovers, especially now, does feel like the best case scenario of a collaborative writer's room, because all of the specific choices feel like the vetted best choices.
Yeah.
Wu-Tang Clan playing on the trampoline, the tattoo being a Wu-Tang Clan tattoo. Last night, okay, we need to have some emotion-triggering thing about Kevin, both Kevins. Okay, an audio tape. Well, what's on the tape? Okay, let's think that through. Similarly, he wanders out of the desert. What's he going to see? A man. Well, what's the man doing? He's pouring gasoline on himself. Why? What does he say? And each example of this, these are the small things, the small specificities that made Lost really good too, I would say.
Yeah.
But to your point, yeah, they were like a second before commercial. The show is built on the back of these little choices. The clever man, just sitting there listening to him, that actor they found, that face. It's just, television is a series of decisions you have to make just to get this thing moving. And so far this season, they're making the most exciting and best choices.
Have you ever seen the director's cut of Apocalypse Now?
I don't know that I have.
I don't even know if it's in the regular version, but Scott Glenn's in it. Like, for one scene, he plays a guy who's been with Brando, like, the whole time. He was the guy who went before Martin Sheen and just decided to join up with Kurtz. And I'm like, in a weird way, it's like, he looks exactly like that guy if he had just stayed with Brando for 30 years and was just like, hey, man, I'm still searching. Just like, it's just an amazing, like, he's been in, like, you know, hundreds of stuff, things since then. But it was just, I was thinking a lot about Apocalypse Now last night.
Oh, my God. I did just recently watch, what was the name of the documentary that they made about?
Hearts of Darkness.
I watched that. And when I, having worked in productions now for a few years, like that first, like, Chiron comes up where it says, like, on this date, filming wrapped, and they had shot, like, it was like 279
miles.
Like 279 production days. And I just, I literally, like, did, my head moved in this way that, like, just physically rejected that information.
That can't be true.
I was like, that's not possible. That's almost a full year.
Yeah, I was reading something the other day where they're like, that, like, there's just because of, like, insurance and the various companies that are involved now, like, they would just, they can't, something couldn't even go that far off.
It could not go that far. And I remember that story about, like, that just all of a sudden they would be shooting and then just all of a sudden the helicopters would leave because they needed them for the war.
Yeah.
Like, that thing again, like, it just, your head just shakes like this. How is this possible?
But you, you were in the film Gold that came out at the end of last year and you filmed it in Thailand. And I remember when we met, I asked you about this because I follow you on Twitter.com.
Oh, lovely.
And you were posting beautiful photos of Thailand. You were enjoying your time there.
Yeah.
And I have to say, from my couch, it seemed like you were there for a pretty long time. And when I saw you, I said, was that a nice family vacation? And you said, oh, no, actually the opposite. I was just in Thailand for, and how long was that?
I was there for, I think, 30 days. I was there for a full month.
And that's not 279 days, but that probably felt like a good amount of time to be
279
away.
Days with a shirtless Francis Coppola being like, new scene.
New scene. Hey, guess what? I did a lot of cocaine and I have some new
Dennis
ideas.
Dennis Hopper's here and I got a tiger. Like, let's make some magic.
I don't know what we got. We got Dennis Hopper and a tiger. Fuck it. Let's do it. Okay, roll.
That's the story of the 70s. No,
I was there for 30 days and it was a really odd experience. It was very different than I'm sure what they went through. But it was like, the part that I had was not 30 days long.
Right.
It was, I think it was 8 days long, but it, because things changed so much because it was the rainy season, we needed to be there the whole time. There's no time to go home and then come back, and stuff changed so often. Like, to that point, like, we got off the plane after we flew for 24 hours. We drove up the coast in a monsoon for 3 hours. I went straight into a haircut in the middle of a rainforest.
It always comes back to the hairstyle.
Yeah, always comes back. I went straight into this haircut. And then we got to the hotel after like 34 hours of traveling and haircuts and the whole thing. And I met the first AD, and I had met Gagan before, like in the auditions. Stephen Gagan, the director. I met him in the auditions. But I met the first AD and the second AD. Fucking fantastic guys, like the perfect AD team to do this job, because the second AD comes and says, hey, what's up, guys? Welcome. Hey, so just chill for now. The set flooded, a river overran. So we're gonna take a little time, we're gonna think about this, but like, grab a glass of wine.
Yeah.
And we ended up, like, it was that sort of thing. Like, the whole set of the base of their camp was built and there, and they showed up to shoot, and it was under 8 feet of water.
Fire festival all over again.
Yeah, it was the fire. And so then it was basically me and these other two guys that played bankers. Just, I went to so many Buddhist temples. I would have these, like, I would work 2 days and I'd have 5 days
like
off.
Street food diary. It was day street seven. Food
yes, it was. Like, it was like, I can't eat any more street food. I have tried all of it. Yeah. I have been to every temple that you have. I ended up at some point, like on the 24th day, just being like, fuck it. And I've stayed in the hotel room and just watched the Americans. I just caught up on the Americans. But it was that thing.
Maybe that's
not
what it would take for Chris to do that.
Yeah, if I got stuck in Thailand.
Day 24 in Thailand.
Yeah. Like, I wasn't necessarily working, but I wasn't necessarily on vacation. So you're in this sort of weird stasis where everybody else is going out into the jungle for these hours and they have this incredibly brutal shooting schedule. And I'm kind of like, I don't really know what to do, because I don't want to, like, celebrate this day off because I want to be a part of this.
Did you get a lot of FaceTime with McConaughey on the street food?
Not on the street food, because he was working those
shots. Did he just drive by in his Lincoln, like, lower the window and be like, imagine a world.
But you know what, man? I was like, it was an amazing experience because he is like, he is a movie star for a reason. And it is because it's fucking awesome to be around Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. And he, like, when we would be at lunch, he would tell stories and like he, the story he ended up using for his Saturday Night Live monologue.
Yeah.
He
workshopped that at lunch.
He told us that story at lunch, like on a rubber farm, on a rubber plantation, like under a tent eating a squid bag while, and we had gone like 20 minutes upriver in a boat.
A bag full of squid.
A bag full of squid, yeah. A bag full of hot squid that you dump on rice. And then we were just eating that and he's telling stories about how he got started and he's awesome. And at one point I saw him, like some of the guys, like some of the guys from Thailand who were playing like the people that worked at the mine. I saw him like he did, like this one guy, like he didn't speak English. But McConaughey went over to him. They kind of like communicated for a moment.
Sometimes McConaughey doesn't speak English.
Yeah, yeah.
They
communicated for a second. They both kind of looked at each other. He like made a little nod and then they both just erupted in laughter and McConaughey walked off. Like he transcends language, yeah. Which is why he's a movie star.
I watched him. There's a show on the Golf Channel called Faraday, which is just like this.
Oh.
Do you watch Faraday?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So
the McConaughey one, I have it DVR'd.
It's amazing.
I've never felt more like,
okay,
that
so
in my life.
There it opens up. I don't want to spoil it, mm-hmm. but it opens up and McConaughey is just like splashing six iron shots from like the fairway. And Faraday's like, "How often do you play, sir?" Because he's like this iron. And McConaughey's like, "Once a year."
Oh,
probably
my God.
Like once every 8 months, man. And he's just like, just kissing like these shots from everywhere. And he's just like wearing like a peach and khaki like golf outfit. And he's just like, yeah, man, I love playing golf.
But I've only seen like the thing. He has like a good swing.
It's great. It's like you should play on the tour. It's amazing.
Yeah. God damn.
I don't know if we could top McConaughey.
No, I think, you know, we had some intention to talk Handmaid's Tale, but I've only watched one episode, which I highly recommend. So maybe, Chris, we can circle back to it on Thursday. We'll tell the listeners that. Tim, I know you expressed interest in watching it, so maybe like many people in our listeners, like everyone's in on it, but it's just
I don't know that I could as a I don't know her super well personally. When I've met her, she's always been great.
Yeah.
I could not be a bigger fan of Elizabeth Moss. Like
she's incredible.
So I will absolutely watch that. But you know, we live in this world and we have children, and they're. Are a 100 million things to watch, but that's super on. That's
he's
got
to get to
list.
This Faraday episode too, man.
Yeah, I got to get to that McConaughey.
But I also have to say, like, and we will
did
talk
you
about
see the one where he talked to Phil Mickelson.
Yeah,
I thought the leather coat was a bit.
Yeah,
much.
It was like, a little extreme.
It was a little extreme. I feel like the stylist made a choice that they should have toned down a little bit.
You can't. You also like Phil is like the quintessential golf style guy.
Yeah,
where it's just like here's like just like a little splash of pink coming out of this V-neck I've got on. So Faraday like really tried to like overdo it with like the formal wear or like the Faraday form. More.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And you made fun of me for talking about Samurai Gourmet. we will talk about the first three episodes of Handmaid's Tale, which are available. I want to encourage people to stick with it and to watch it. We had a night last week where I was like, we should watch Handmaid's Tale. We're excited. It's available. We had a long day, got kids.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was trying to sell my wife on like watching Ali Wong Baby Cobra or something. I'm mm-hmm. like, sometimes you just want to laugh, you know? And she's like, no, we have to do it. And we said, and TV should never be like that kind of homework, but it's rough. It's brilliant. It's beautiful. It's beautifully shot. She is so good, but it's a tough hang. So I think people got it. So I think giving people a little extra time to watch it.
I mean, I think it's tough, but I think
it's invigorating in the way that like you see the way that it's directed.
It's pretty entertaining.
You see the performance.
I mean, not entertaining, but like the voiceover, like the way it's just, I think it's paced well. It's really good.
That's one of the things I want to talk about. It's you watch the first hour just purely as a TV pilot and you think about this beloved book that you have to sort of, you have to get into and chop up and adapt and draw people in. It is perfectly paced in terms of introducing you to a world, getting you, drawing you in, and then not murdering you with the severity. It is.
Awesome.
I now I feel like I've made it sound harder than it is. It's not.
Yeah, we in person saw Justin Turner hit a home run in the left field on the Phillies in the bottom of the ninth.
That's true.
That was the hardest thing I saw.
You're sitting at a table with two guys who went to see their favorite team at Dodger Stadium up three runs in the ninth inning and then lose on back-to-back-to-back home runs.
Yeah, on Corey Seager bobble
so
that night.
What I'm saying is think about us.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're the real sufferers.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Tim. Any last words that you want to send us out with on terms of where Jonah's going this season? Is there like a buzzword? Is there an image you want to tease us with for
this is what I always go back to with him is that There has been no shortage of people who are charmless and talentless, failing upward in Washington. And that's the thing I think that Jonah really gets to attack this year, is like that he starts to like make some waves in Congress, which I love. And there is something like, this is what I always think about when I think about Jonah, is that so when I did a lot of research in between last year and this year, now that he was in Congress, like I talked to congressmen and congresswomen and staffers to like mm-hmm. really get an idea of like what being a first year congressman mm-hmm. actually is and what does that look like. And one of the things that came up was this joke about Ted Cruz, which is that he is so universally hated. Mm-hmm. They said that if you killed Ted Cruz on the floor of the Senate, you would not be able to find a witness. And that's what I really do feel like that's like the lasting picture of Jonah as a representative. Yeah. That's like, it's just like, that's who that guy is. And then just somehow Ted Cruz fell ass backwards into this somehow, like this power, despite no talent and no charm.
No friends.
And like, no friends.
Nobody even wants to like, nobody's ever like, but Ted Cruz is a cool hang.
No, and that's,
you know, like, they'll be like, this guy's Satan, but like if you get him in a bar, he is the like the king. But yeah. like Ted Cruz, everybody's just like, get this guy out of my office.
Get this guy out of here.
I don't want to wish ill of any of like the sane Republicans that do exist in the world, but when their choice was Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, there was something poetic in that, even without.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so that's what I would say.
And we all, bad poetry kills you every time. Yeah. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, no man,
problem,
thanks for
guys.
Coming
this
by.
Has been great.
Following its tour de force off-Broadway show, Chris Gethard Career Suicide is coming to HBO. After his public response to an anonymous fan letter about depression went viral, Chris was encouraged to tell stories about the darker moments in his life, merging blunt, unapologetic honesty with his signature brand of comedy. By opening up about his own mental health struggles in this raw, provocative one-man show, Chris's hope is to destigmatize issues like depression and suicide while still being incredibly funny. See how Chris's comedy and extensive stand-up experience cut through this dark subject matter in Chris Gethard Career Suicide. That's premiering Saturday, May 6th at 10 p.m. on HBO. Don't forget, Bosch is back for a third season. Titus Welliver stars as Detective Harry Bosch, an honest cop driven by a dark past who is obsessed with punishing criminals, no matter what the cost. Bosch is based on the best-selling novels by Michael Connelly. Stream season 3 of Bosch now on Amazon Prime. Bosch!